If you get into one of my cars, you get into it.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Waffle Press Retrospectives. Failed award contenders. We're here to talk about Ford v. Ferrari, directed by James Mangold. Oh, wait, no, that's the other movie. That's the other one. I'm your host, Diego Crespo.
That was the one that was actually nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, that's my co-host, Macaringo.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that was the movie that maybe James Mangold kind of poached the leads from Michael Mann, who was developing Ferrari for like a decade by that point.
But doesn't Ford v. Ferrari have Michael Mann as like an executive producer on it? Like,
yeah, basically because he did so much work, like prep work on his Ferrari, which I think at one point was even like partially what Ford v. Ferrari becomes.
Yeah.
Like he's basically kind of teed up that movie. Mm-hmm. But instead he finally got to make his Ferrari.
I think it's one of these things that has worked. I think it worked out better for him in a weird way. Like, I think getting Ford v. Ferrari out of there kind of like it put up some sort of like, well, now here are some things to avoid because they've already been done. Right. Like,
yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. And you know what? It kind of sounds like I'm shitting on Ford v. Ferrari and James Mangold. I really like that movie, and I really like Mangold as a filmmaker. So I have no beef there. I just think that's very interesting how that worked out.
Yeah.
Because well, both Jackman and Bale were, like, not just in talks, but they were signed up to be the leads of Mann's Ferrari at one point.
And this is one, but this is also,
and now they're both in that one.
It's been in the works for, like, over a decade, right? Like, it's one of those...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the long gestation period of this movie. And it was... Mm. There was kind of something where when Ford v. Ferrari came out, it was kind of like, okay, well, it's definitely not going to happen now, right? Like, that was kind of the reaction.
Yeah.
Of just, like, it's done. And then, I think in a weird way, Ford v. Ferrari getting nominated for Best Picture and making, like, $200 million kind of made people go like, actually, let's do another Ferrari movie. And then it comes out and wins no awards and bombs at the box office. But
yeah, his second bomb in a row.
Yeah, but you know, but he's smart because now he's doing Heat 2, right?
Yep.
That's the smart move. Like, now it's like, okay,
no, it is
two bombs in a row. And now I get to go back to my quote unquote franchise.
Yeah.
Which is a movie where like, everyone's dead by the end, or like it's. But hey, whatever. You know, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. No, for those that haven't read the book, I'm not going to spoil it. But the movie basically follows like three timelines, and it's like it's covering all of man's fascination with like here's a crime in the analog era, here's the transitional era, and here's the digital era, and you follow three different viewpoints, some returning characters, some new characters, and It is kind of like an insane pivot. It is him trying to do like the Godfather Part 2, but digital. You know,
like, I mean, I'm down with that. Like, that sounds like the best.
Oh, yeah.
Pitch ever.
Yeah, no. It's a great read. I think it's gonna make a fucking fantastic movie. I'm very curious about what he like is gonna, if he's gonna change anything or not, because there's like a lot in there, and like, you're like, what's a Michael Mann book like? Because he puts so much detail into his scripts, and he knows like the ins and outs of these individuals' lives, even if they're not in the screenplay. Well, he puts it all in the book. So like, I don't like, it's like 10 pages in, and I'm like, oh yeah, I never knew this about Chris Chehurlihy's, and I've seen Heat like 20 times.
He does kind of go on tangents a little bit, but in a good way. I can't judge a man for doing that.
No, he's 80 years old and he's like not afraid of death. Let him do whatever he wants.
Well, they have the balls to call it Heat 2, though.
That's what I'm curious about, because they're like Heat
to the grave.
Yeah. I was trying to think of something. I was like, I don't even know. Heat, because you can't do Heat Legacy. People would fucking riot.
Yeah.
You can't do like Heat Resurrection.
Heat Origins.
Although that might fit the Chris arc in that book. Mm-hmm. But like that wouldn't be a good title for the rest of it. Yeah, you'd have to come up with like the greatest subtitle in movie history.
Heats,
yeah, with the dollar sign at the end.
yeah, basically.
Yeah. But who knows? This isn't the Heat 2 podcast. Oh, yeah. No, I can't fucking wait.
Is Austin Butler in it, right? Like, that's like what everyone's
Austin Butler is at this time slotted to play Chris Chihurly's, so the Val Kilmer character.
It is one of those, like, that's a great choice. Like,
it's so fucking good. I never thought of that, and it's so good. That kid is so fuck. I say kid, he's older than us. That kid is so fucking good.
We're still kids, actor. Right? We're still young. Time hasn't ravaged our bodies yet. But no, he's great. Like, especially after I've just seen Dune 2. He's so fucking good in it. I mean, and he's having a fucking blast with that performance. So. Where he's like kind of doing the Elvis voice, but also kind of doing Skarsgård's voice, like to be like, see, we're related. Like, and then meanwhile, you have fucking Dave Bautista there who just sounds like Dave Bautista. But I mean, I'm not complaining. It works. So.
Yeah, I mean, because Bautista is. You know what? I haven't seen Dune 2 at the time of this recording. That's just got me so fucking hyped because I'm so pro Bautista, I'm so pro Butler, like, and they're in the same space together.
Oh yeah,
and I'm sure there's not that many scenes of them together because I know where those characters end up, but that is very exciting to me now.
Here's the thing: I would say Bautista probably has less than like 10 minutes of screen time, right? Like he's a very minor character, mm-hmm. but it's all great. Like it's all good stuff.
Yeah.
It's a lot of him just being like, ah, it's what you want from Dave Bautista.
Good.
And yeah, like it's Butler. And then who's the other guy that's popping right now from fucking Saltburn? Who it's like, he's now in everything.
Well, there's everyone's favorite little weirdo, Barry Keoghan.
But he's already been around.
Jacob Elordi, the other Elvis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, the two Elvises, because, like, now he's Frankenstein's monster, right? Like,
yeah.
He's got a few things coming up, and it is one of those things where you watch that movie Saltburn, and you're like, I'll fucking watch whatever this guy's in. Like,
yeah, like, I don't think it was, like, the best performance of the year or anything, but he was, like, really magnetic.
No, it's not the performance, like, no offense to the guy, he's good in it, right? Like, but it's not like, wow, this is a transformative performance, it's just, like, he's got that movie star thing where you're just like, I want to see this guy in movies. Like, you're like, I like watching him on the screen. And in a weird way, I think Adam Driver has a similar quality to him.
I was going to pivot that way too. Yeah. Yes. Adam Driver is absolutely, he had that and he still has that.
Yeah.
And he picks very interesting roles like those other actors are doing now.
Yeah. You know? He's great. It's so, I want to fucking kick J.J. Abrams in the teeth sometimes because it's like he's the guy that you could build Star Wars around the guy, right? Like he's so good as Kylo Ren and he's only getting better as an actor and it's like, well, no, he fell down a hole.
His famous last words.
who let that happen? Like...
Basically Bob Iger, but we don't have time to unpack all that.
Yeah, fucker.
We could do a whole podcast on why I am getting really fascinated in watching bad movies, not to laugh at, just to like kind of do postmortems on, you know?
Yeah. Well, they all seem to
I do think there's something to that.
There's something about them all having like similar problems, right? Like that are just indicative of where the industry is at. I wouldn't say
that's what I'm really like getting into right now. Like that's why I want to see Madam Web still.
Yeah, I'll wait to see Madam Web on when it's like streaming for, you know, nothing. But but there is that thing about that.
Like, we're gonna go back to Ferrari. Oh, yeah, but I just want to say I want to see Madam Web specifically because I want to see if in the 10 years since The Amazing Spider-Man 2, if there are still the same flaws or if there are entirely new flaws now.
Yeah. I've heard takes on Madam Web, which are essentially like that it's trying so desperately to be kind of like a schlock movie. Like it wants to be more like have fun with how ridiculous its existence is. And you can tell that someone came in and was like, no, this has to be a more conventional movie. That like, it was prevented from being like, it was essentially prevented from being a bad movie by being made into a worse movie. which is kind of fascinating when you think about it. But because how do you make Dakota Johnson boring, right?
Yeah, I don't know, because she's got charisma.
Yeah, another one where it's just like, and like it's a problem where like the avenues for an actress like her are so specific that it's like, well, now you're Madame Web, right? Like,
yeah, everyone's favorite Spider-Man character.
Yeah, God, I mean, hindsight 2020, I guess. I guess when you sign up for Madame Web in like 2019, it makes more sense, right? Like, it's just after Endgame, yeah. You know. But I mean,
and then after No Way Home was like to audiences and to the box office a fucking home run slam dunk in the yeah. same like venue. It's like, all right, we're cooking. A year later, wait. I don't know about this anymore.
They must have
2 years later. It's oh no.
They must have shit a fucking brick when they saw the box office returns on Morbius.
Like, oh yeah,
because they were already too deep in the Madame Web and Kraven the Hunter, right? Like, you can't stop mm-hmm. now. So
yeah,
it's
yeah,
but everything's they. Someone was smart enough to cancel the Silver Sable movie, which was one of the ones they were.
Well, that was gonna be Black Cat and Silver Sable, and that was gonna be Gina Prince Bythewood.
Yeah, and she dodged a fucking bullet is what I'm saying. Like, she probably would have
sure, but she's a good director.
She's a great director.
She's made nothing but good movies.
She's a great director. She would have made a better movie than most of these. She dodged a fucking bullet because that thing would have been so executively interfered on, right? Like,
yeah.
It would have been a battle every day, and she would have lost some and she would have won some, and the movie would have come out as a compromise thing, and then it would still bomb, right? And
mm-hmm.
And the studio would probably be like, well, if she had just listened, it would have been a hit. Man.
Yeah.
She had The Old Guard instead, which is a much better movie than anything in the superhero realm these days.
Mm.
Or The Woman King, which was also great.
Yeah, really good movie. I'm trying to pivot back. The Adam Driver pivot was pretty good. Yeah, I don't know why. This is a great movie. It was my favorite movie of last year. Is it the best movie of 2023? I don't know, but it's a Michael Mann movie, so obviously it would have had to, like, heaven and earth would have had to have been moved for this not to be my favorite movie the year of its release.
Well, that's
right?
Where
like,
that's where I'm kind of at with the movie. Where like I think it's a great movie. I'm not as in love with it as you are, but I think that's just because I've only watched it like twice at this point, right? And then Michael Mann is such a stacked filmography that to be like, it's a top five Michael Mann would be like being like, it's one of the best movies ever made. And it's a little hard to.
Oh yeah. I do not think that for the record.
Well, I mean, I like, you know, I love Michael Mann. Like there's definitely at least five Michael Mann movies that could make my top 100. Right. Like he's made a lot of great movies. So that's what it's in contention with when it comes to trying to figure out where. And this is going to sound like a criticism, but it really isn't. Because, like I said, I love this movie. But what kind of threw me about Ferrari is that it's an unconventional biopic, right? It's by most people. But it's a more conventional Michael Mann movie, you know? And it feels like from Miami Vice, the last three movies are Miami Vice, Public Enemies, and Black Cat, which are him being really unconventional, right? It's really him pushing the boundaries of essentially what he can get away with as a director. And then Ferrari feels almost like a return to form. Like it feels more in line with something, you know, maybe like The Insider or even like Last of the Mohicans, I would say. It's a more conventional story while still being an unconventional biopic. And I just wasn't expecting that, you know?
I might have been a little disappointed almost that it was conventional if it wasn't so effective.
Yeah. It's one of those where like I kind of went in wanting, you know, it's the thing that happens sometimes where I had this with just because it's a movie I love. I had this with The Master where I went to see The Master and I kind of wanted There Will Be Blood Part 2, right? And The Master isn't that. The Master's a masterpiece, but it's not There Will Be Blood Part 2. And I kind of went in the Ferrari being like, I want Black Hat Part 2 because I'm so Black Hat pilled at this point.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not that, but it's still a great movie. So like, but it's still building for me in terms of like where I rank it among his other movies, right?
Yeah, I'm at the point where I can't put it above like the number 10 slot. Like, the only things I have below it are Jericho Mile, The Keep, Public Enemies, and, of course, L.A. Takedown, his one actually bad movie, quote-unquote. But I call Ferrari, like, it's the least shiny five stars of his five-star run, but it's still five stars for me, you know? Like, yeah, I obviously loved it, and I think it's terrific.
And that got it to your best of the year, even with that, even with those qualifiers on it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's not
at the very least, it's my favorite. Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't have Killa Harkin, though, from John Wick 4, so I can't give it number one.
Oh, yeah, but that's understandable.
That's
maybe a valid choice.
That's maybe the best sequence in a movie of the century, so...
Well, that's Orson Welles if he was in John Wick.
I know. It would have been amazing. Goddamn, if only Orson had lived long enough for John Wick.
Anyway. I know. 100-year-old Orson Welles in John Wick 4.
If only Orson should have been the first immortal, just so we can keep putting him in movies that absolutely don't deserve his gravitas. Like, he gets to be immortal, but he can't be in anything that is like an A picture. Like, he has to. He has to be slumming it, so...
No, here's my pitch in an alternate reality. Orson doesn't do just any Michael Mann movie. He only pops up in The Keep.
Oh my god, he should have voiced the fucking demon in it.
I was gonna say. Yeah. The plot of Ferrari is really simple. It takes place over the course of like 4 months in like a 4 mile radius for 2 hours, and it's about Ferrari trying to save his failing business. That's really it. And trying to balance his personal life and private life and business life. And those things, they cannot occupy the same space at the same point in time.
It's a real stretch for someone like Michael Mann, about a male protagonist who can compartmentalize the different facets of his life, but those walls are ultimately the thing that are holding him back. It's a real stretch.
If you've seen one Michael Mann movie, you have seen all of them, but you've also seen none of them. And that's what I keep loving about him as a filmmaker.
No, it's like it's why we watch the movies. Like, it's not it's a recurring theme, but it's a good one, right?
Even his imagery gets very like, he's got these signifiers, not necessarily repetitious, but, and apparently, allegedly, he does not go out of his way to shoot for them. It's just how he knows how to tell these stories. Mm-hmm. So from the scripting stage to the visual stage, it's like, he's got one mode, but he's the best at it. So like, when Ferrari's looking out over that, like, that track, when they're trying to beat the, I forget the other, Maserati's, like, time, going around the track in their new car, they're like, we got to beat it now. We're going to take it back right now. And so he's looking out over that stretch of concrete, and it's like the over-the-shoulder shot. I was like cheering in my seat at opening night. I was like, yeah, like, there it is. But it's also like he's looking out at something that man made, surrounded by nature, and you still ultimately can't control the outcome. You know, you can only put things into motion that allow you to like chase after it. And it's just like, oh my god, it's all right there in that image still. This movie's also viscerally violent for like 5 minute bursts, and I was frankly not prepared for that. Mm-hmm. I did not know that was gonna happen. I did not have any familiarity with this era of Enzo Ferrari's life. What were you familiar with?
that's something. I know jack shit about cars, so like it. I basically went into this blind, so I don't even... He could have made everything up that happened. Like, that race might not even have been real, and I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I had kind of been tipped off that there was a violent car accident in the movie. So, when I went into it, I kind of was, like, waiting for it, almost. So...
Because
there's one early on, and I was like, well, that couldn't have been it. And then another one happened. I was like, that one was definitely
it. Yeah, so there's the early one. I was like, whoa. Like, I felt the air get sucked out of the room. And then I remember seeing the trailers with the car crash in the trailers. I don't know what it was. Maybe the VFX wasn't done or they slowed it down for the trailer. It looked rough. In motion, didn't even clock that it was, like, even a fake car because it happened so fast. But, like, when that happened, I was like, oh, okay, here's the crash. It's pretty rough. And then it gets really rough. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I heard someone – when the car goes over that object in the on the street and you see it slowly crash into the tire and it, like, causes that eruption, someone behind me was like, oh, shit. And I just that was very fun to experience everyone feel what that guy was saying.
Mm-hmm. Not to add to the canon of Macaringo knows incredibly fucked up things.
Okay.
Do you know the 1955 Le Mans disaster?
I don't.
It's one of the early. We caught a race car accident on camera type things. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like cars were coming around a turn right near the stadium stands. The car just goes flying into the audience and it was caught on camera, like by two angles. One camera catches the car coming directly at it. And because it's on film, you can watch it. And like right before the car hits, the film just ends because it like all exploded, right? Because the car mm-hmm. like directly hit it, and the other shows it hit the stands. There's no way, man essentially watched that and took that image of what that car did when it wrecked and used that for Ferrari, like the imagery he's using of the car just like fucking cutting the people down. There's real footage like that out there. It's black and white footage, so it kind of it doesn't have the same, but it's one of those like horrific reminders of like, oh yeah, the human body is just a fucking sack of meat that can like our lives can be extinguished easily in an instant if fucking metal comes flying into it, right? And then we're just fucking ragdolled. Like the Le Mans disaster in 55 killed 84 people.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It was a really bad one.
I think it
might be the biggest of all time. Like, I think, and they still do Le Mans. This race, the one in this, when it happened, they never did the race again afterwards. So
yeah.
That's
a little crazy.
Yeah, cars are insane. Don't go near them.
Yeah, I know. No, cars are fucking scary. That's what this movie ultimately like made me think about. The cars are fucking terrifying.
I'm so
and that's so much car, of our like society. Yeah, so much of our society in America revolves around them. Mm-hmm. Makes me angrier at America.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like, oh, we made a mistake. Like we shouldn't have done everything around the car. Thanks, Robert Moses, you anti-Semitic fuck. I don't know if he's anti-Semitic, but he was definitely racist.
Then he was, probably was anti-Semitic too.
Well, he was also.
There seems to be overlap there.
I'm trying to remember if he was Jewish is the problem because he is.
Oh,
his name's Robert Moses. So I was like, was he Jewish? But he was definitely racist because he conveniently built all the roads to go around black neighborhoods. So all the highways went around them. And basically, you know what they call white flight from the cities? He basically engineered that. Like, it was a thing he made happen. So, fuck that guy. And then every city in America followed his design, and then all our cities went bankrupt.
Well.
Thanks, Robert Moses. He's dead, though.
Yeah. Good riddance.
Are you a Los Angeles Dodgers fan?
Unfortunately.
You are? Well, you can thank Robert
I feel
Moses
like I just...
for that because he drove the Dodgers out of Brooklyn.
Because
he didn't want them.
I'm not going to say thank you to that guy. Dodger Stadium like fucked up that community.
Yeah, but Dodger Stadium was like the first modern stadium. Like it changed how baseball was done. it for worse, arguably. Everything's good, Diego. Robert Moses was, he was German Jewish, so he wasn't anti-Semitic, unless he was just like crazy. But
I mean, that can happen. They're self-hating like Mexicans, you know.
They're self-hating everything.
Yeah. I'm just staying in my lane. That's all.
Yeah. Self-hating Italians, and I think they all worked on this movie.
And House of Gucci.
Hey.
Yeah, these are your people, right? Adam Driver, he's one of your guys.
Yeah, is he? I actually don't know.
No, I don't know. Is he, like, honorary, though, at least, at this point?
I don't know if I can. I haven't talked. We haven't discussed this in any of the recent meetings with the fellow old Italians, because they're all dying of arthritis. But
well, look, there were some dissidents of this move. Well, no. I'm going to mention specific people by name. I want to shit on them. No, I'm not. But there was just people that didn't really respond to this movie, and they were like, yeah, it's kind of boring. Doesn't really have a point by the end. And I'm like, I'll get to that, because I think the reason it's such like a non-stereotypical biopic is that like it realizes, and this is why he wanted to tackle the material. Real life doesn't have like catharsis. You just kind of keep your walls up. You kind of, you try to keep balancing everything, even though you're kind of full of shit, you know? And this movie is very much not pro Enzo Ferrari. It's just about him, you know? Yeah. Like, but I don't think his motivational speeches are very motivational.
It's less about him being like a motivate, like that his speeches are ones we agree with. It's more about like how this guy got people to like follow him on to do this stuff, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if a movie that like has a scene that definitely didn't need to be in it where he sells a car to Hussein in it. I don't know if that I don't know if he included that to make him look good, because that's a scene you really don't need in the movie, right? Like, but
you do if you're trying to make a point.
Yeah. But I would say I agree with you. There's not really catharsis, but I do think there is a sort of there's a I don't know what the word is. There's an optimism at the end of this movie, right? There is a certain hope that the walls can come down, even in someone who's built them up as much as Enzo has, right? Like,
There's that.
I mean, the last night, like, everyone shares that fucking clip of him being like, two things cannot occupy the same space at the same time, right? Which is essentially his philosophy for everything, right? Like, that's part of the movie, is that I put up walls on every... I mean, he straight up says that, right? And then, not to jump to the end, but Penelope Cruz gives that whole speech, and it was like, you know, Dino, the son that died, was like, he had a lot of like your best qualities in you, right? And like he was like his point, like all that stuff. She gives that whole speech, and then the next scene is him at the cemetery with his other son, and he has that comment where he's like, "I wish you had known." It's the last line of the movie. "I wish you had known Dino. He would have taken you with him everywhere," right? Mm-hmm. That's the last line of the movie. Coming from a guy whose whole thing is not taking his son everywhere. But right after Penelope Cruz overtly makes the connection that Dino was his son, that there was that Enzo was in Dino and Dino wasn't Enzo, right? So
yeah.
I think it is something where that he's not... I think unlike a lot of other man protagonists who are ultimately doomed to be these closed off people, I think the ending of this is less that he's not as doomed. He the walls can come down for Enzo, right? That he is not doomed to this, and it is not something that makes him better, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like it's I think for the first time man has overtly been like, cause you know, his protagonists are very like that, but it's like, they're kind of closed off. And this is also what gives them their strength. Now, their strength is usually like being a cop or being a bank robber or something that is not admirable, but in this instance it feels like for the first time he's like that it's man being more like, I'm obsessed with these type of people. It doesn't necessarily mean I agree that that's how you should live your life, right? Like,
yeah.
Although this does feel like the first, this is one of those movies that does feel, not to be like the basic reading of it, but this does feel like one of those movies that is ultimately about making movies, you know, that, that when Ferrari, Adam Driver, talks about making cars and shit, he's talking about making movies, you know, and it's just overtly that. So
do not bring that up to Michael Mann. I think someone tried to bring that up to him and he did not like that.
Of course he would deny it. Like, look, he made the movie. I watched it. So yeah. I get it. Like, I bet you a guy like Michael Mann at his age is sick of people being like, oh, he's secretly like his protagonists, right? No director wants to get saddled with that, right? It's annoying. But when he gives the whole speech about, what's he say to the son about the car?
He's talking about the engine?
Yeah, when a thing works better, usually it is more beautiful to the eye. That's his line.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that's not Michael Mann's philosophy on filmmaking.
I agree with you. I'm just saying, don't bring it up to him.
When am I going to be in the room with Michael Mann?
Well, look, I just was like 2 months ago, and it was awesome.
I would.
Although
dare.
I maybe have complained about this before, but I'm going to do it again because look, if you're going to like a Michael Mann retrospective screening, I feel like you're the type of nerd that knows like the do's and don'ts of talking to Michael Mann and asking about certain things, right?
That is why I avoid Q&As, because I know that there's always one fucker who doesn't know it. Like, and I don't want to be in the room when that fucker talks.
It was so one of the last questions, and it was supposed to be the last question, and I think they pivoted and did one more, but like someone asked about like, will he go back to the keep? And everyone groaned because it's like, we've known he's never doing it. He's talked about it ad nauseum. But yeah. And like, I was showing, cause it was for Collateral and friends were there for the first time, seeing it for the first time. And they were like, you don't want to ask him anything? And I was just like, I listened to basically every available Michael Mann interview ever. Yeah. Like I just want to hear him talk. I have nothing to ask. I just need to listen to the master, you know, like
if I
just gotta sit down and listen.
Here's the thing. If I had been there for that, did they do the Q&A after the movie? I'm assuming.
Yeah.
I would have been like, they would have brought him out, been like, here's Michael Mann. Then I would have been like, there he is. And then I would have left. So like, cause I just, I cannot do Q&As, man. Like,
I think it was Bilge Ebery at Vulture.
His stuff with Man guy, like
his stuff is good, and when they take like audience Q&As like at BAM in New York, they have them email the questions and they solicit them that way. I think that's a way better method, because that way you can filter out the bullshit.
Significantly better method.
Yeah, because if you find a good question, you can ask it that way. And if you don't have a good question, go with God.
Yeah. Don't ask about, are you going to re-edit fucking Black Hat again?
Yeah. To pivot to Black Hat for a little bit, because you mentioned that Ferrari, you think it's like the more optimistic ending for a man protagonist. I don't entirely agree. I think Black Hat is a very optimistic ending, but it is like, they do have to forsake like all physical bonds apart from each other to be able to live like in solace, because the grid is like so broken by the end of that movie, and maybe in a reality. I think that's a beautiful ending.
Black Cat is optimistic on the man scale, right? Like when it's gonna be like, it's like, okay, it's a very similar ending of a guy being like, he's fucked and has to go off on his own. But that time he's not alone. He found someone he loved, right? Like, they're still fucked. They still have to go off the grid for the rest of their lives. But they, you know, as long as they're together, it makes it worth it. Which, like, on the Michael Mann scale, it's like, yeah, that's the happy ending.
Yeah.
But, like, I just feel like Ferrari is the more overt, like, his, like, it's very much like, okay, yeah, he's gonna, his son is officially his son, right? He's not just the replacement son anymore. He's not just yes. another part, like, everything else in his fucking life. But, so like that, it felt a little more optimistic for Michael Mann's type stuff. It almost felt like it was one of those weird ones where like with that and like the ending of Killers of the Flower Moon, where it's like, do these guys know they're dying? Like, do they know?
I mean,
this is it? Like, it got, it, like they both endings freaked me out in that kind of way.
I mean, Scorsese and Mann are people that I feel like even though Scorsese has said he thinks he only has a couple more movies left in him. I do think they still operate the same, you know. I think Scorsese's yeah. just more sentimental, and Mann is like, I don't know, I want to do this, I'm going to do it. Yeah. I do think they ultimately fall in very similar places, though. And I love that you mentioned like Ferrari's like compartmentalizing of like his life yeah. and like his like the life that he ultimately felt he deserved with not Lara, what's the other one? I forgot the names already. With Shailene Woodley. Mm-hmm. Lena, excuse me.
Yeah.
And like even the opening of the movie, after you get the the CG oh, yeah. Adam Driver on the racetrack. Mixing with real footage though.
Love this movie. It's a masterpiece. That is one of the most comical openings in recent memory.
It's a little silly. He looks like a gopher when he's driving.
It feels like those things where people like take The Sopranos and edit it into Mario Kart 8. Like it kind of
okay,
has
but besides that
vibe.
That.
Yeah, I kind of love it.
That is
it.
A little.
I kind of love it. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not even here being like movie ruined. Like dang.
But, no, like, yeah. I love it too funny. Because this is my defense of it. It is Mann extrapolating his approach to this story that actually happened and giving it his digital flourish where he's like, okay, there's real stuff around this, but my approach, my telling of this factual event is mine. And so that's why Adam Driver's like, that's my excuse for that.
Okay. All right.
Buy it or don't. But the subsequent scene, the opening where it opens on like that valley of Modena, and then it like fades into their bodies in the blankets, I was like, oh, he's fucking cooking. Like, this is the shit. Like, immediately.
Also, just because I like tying what we do into the movies we've covered on the show, there's another, the first, let me see how long we got. First 26 minutes are all like one of those like in one day type things. After that, I couldn't tell if it bled into the next day. It kind of does, right? Like we kind of get the next day, but I couldn't tell if it was like if the first like 30 or so minutes of this movie were the first 2 days. Very similar to the opening of Babylon, but done significantly better, frankly. In terms,
oh yeah,
of,
this is a
we are now informed more deeply about the character and the type of story we're going by seeing what one day of their life looks like and then kind of getting to the end of that day and being like, wow, that was all in one day. What a stressful life without the camera fucking zooming around everywhere.
A couple things. Totally agree. And like the opening is so like soft and quiet. And I don't remember yeah. the last time, if ever, a Michael Mann movie has opened that way, which is so perfect because it's like, this is his idyllic life. This is everything he wants as a family man, not a businessman, but a family man. And even just the way he like pushes the car out of the driveway without turning it on first, so he doesn't disturb yeah. it. It's perfect. That it's makes also up for why Shailene Woodley is kind of the weak link of this movie because
you know
she
what?
Photographs very well and that's kind of all that performance needs. I don't even think she's bad. I just think everyone else is kind of given all-timer shit here.
I think she's not given as much to work. I think she's good in this. Like, I don't know what people are talking about, honestly. I feel like we're all kind of annoyed with Shailene Woodley. Like she kind of had a weird arc to her career, right? she had like the Divergent stuff, and then wasn't she dating fucking what's his fuck for a little bit?
An anti-vaxxer, yeah.
Yeah, Aaron Rodgers, and then it was like we don't talk about politics, and then they got like engaged, but then they split up, right? So who really knows what was going on there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, she's a white woman in Hollywood. She's probably just weird. It's fine. That's not my concern.
Yeah. I think she's getting a little too much shit for her performance, right?
You know what it is, I think, for at least a lot of people? I don't think she has the Italian accent down, which but is like, whatever. What? Fine. I don't give a shit about that.
But you know what? She doesn't like press it, right? Like she does. It doesn't feel like she's like coming into the room and being like "Mamma Mia," like everyone else in this movie. She kind of does. She kind of seems to know her range with it and keeps it a little more simple, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Man would agree with you there. Man went to bat for her. Not that he was ever attacked. Like, what's up with Shailene Woodley? But he went out of his way to mention her performance. He called her like great, like on several.
I wonder if it's just because of how the character is, because she's supposed to kind of be separate from his life, so she's such a different energy than a lot of the other people in his life, right?
I don't agree with those criticisms. I just think she can't quite match everyone's level.
She's going up against insane Italians, like she's a stable Italian, so she has no chance. But I get what you're gonna say, and I'm gonna steal your thunder, is that the other female performance in this is Penelope Cruz giving like a career high, like peak. Like, this is arguably the best performance of her career, right? Like,
yeah. It's up there. She has obviously done a lot of great work with Pedro Almodovar. Yes. And so I don't want to discredit any of that. Stuff like Volver and recently Parallel Mothers or All About My Mother. Mm-hmm. Like she's just fucking, that's her heavyweight shit. Ferrari, if not better, it is at least of the same caliber. Mm-hmm. She is devastatingly good in this.
Yeah,
like, it is one of the best performances in a Michael Mann movie.
Yeah.
It is one of the best performances I've ever seen on the big screen.
It feels in part with the kind of shift that like his movies are kind of starting to get more like dominant female performances in them, right? Like, it took him until he was 81 to do it, but at least he's doing it. So,
yeah.
Especially like off of Black Hat, which felt like it was kind of like a real shift in that respect. She's arguably the best part of the movie, even though I think Adam Driver is terrific. So,
Adam Driver is incredible. Mm-hmm. And I feels like that's kind of a softball now, but no, he's really incredible in this one. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of his best performances.
It's insane. This isn't nominated for anything, is it? Like, it's,
nope.
Yeah, it is kind of insane. Nothing.
Yeah. There's, I want to bring up the dissidents really quickly too, because someone tweeted out like Adam Driver's got to stop playing Italians. He's not good at it. And I'm like, how do you watch this movie and not at least be like interested in his performance?
Yeah, it's well,
I don't understand that.
That's currently like the top review on Letterboxd, right? That like,
is it?
Yeah, I think the top review on Letterboxd is something like Adam Driver, if you keep playing Italians, you will be arrested or something dumb like that. Like,
Okay. Maybe that's where I saw it, but there's certain critical minds out there just me being petty, but they loved Babylon and this, they were like, what a disaster. And I'm just like, who are you?
Yeah.
What are you doing with your life?
Not to throw my Italian privilege around, but like Italians are just like that. he's very Italian. What the fuck? But the guy can't have fun. We're not allowed to party anymore. Like, I don't know. He's got such an Italian walk in this movie too, which is the best part of his performance. He's so good at walking in this movie.
I love his walk in this movie.
I know, it's like it's amazing, and so I totally don't know. I'm looking at the best actor nominations right now, and it's a pretty good year, right? Like, for best actor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Rustin, so I don't know Coleman Domingo's performance, right? Like, that's the one.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard it's very good.
Yeah. But, you know.
And he's always terrific.
And I'm a defender of Bradley Cooper's Maestro, so, like, I feel like people would be like, get rid of Maestro, put in Ferrari, right? I feel like that would be. But it's a pretty stacked year. In terms of supporting actress, which I feel like Penelope Cruz would get the supporting actress nomination.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not gonna name names, but there's a few you could cut.
Oh, okay. Hang on. I wanna know who you're talking shit about. Let me check.
I mean, there's people supporting. I very much respect in that category that I also feel like, you know, let's maybe we've nominated them enough. Is I'll say about one of them.
I would agree with you. I didn't realize that one is it's a little light, but there's two great choices in there.
There are,
and they're the ones people are talking about. So
yeah, which means they'll probably split the vote, and then some other bullshit will win.
yeah. I really loved Divine Joy Randolph in The Holdovers. I think obviously she's gonna win, and then America Ferrara. I've always loved her, and I thought she was very good in Barbie. And people are weird about that in ways I think she even didn't anticipate. So maybe chill out there. You could easily slot in Penelope Cruz.
Yeah, you could find room for Penelope Cruz on that list, is all I'll say. But
what's an IAD? Anyways, that is absurd. That she wasn't nominated. The distribution company for this is actually pretty good at getting awards attention. So I'm really surprised by this.
Neon distributed Parasite, right? Like,
yeah.
It felt like, I'll say this, like, Neon's usually really good at distributing. It felt like they kind of fumbled the Ferrari release, like, at the end, right? Like
a little bit, yeah.
It felt like it had momentum, and then it kind of just came out, and then no one saw it, right? Like, there was, like, a moment where it had the momentum, and for whatever reason, it got kind of boxed out by whatever else we were discussing at the time. But just before I forget, I watched NIAD, and then the Academy Awards... and then the Academy Awards were announced, the nominations, and I saw Annette Bening and NIAID, and I was like, the fuck is NIAID? I had seen the movie and forgot about it. So, I'm sure Diane Nyad was a lovely woman.
Or wasn't she a liar?
Oh, was she? Is that the story?
Yeah.
Did
she lied about doing that swim?
Oh. Oh my god, the integrity of the film NIAID has been called into question. how can I respect a film ever again, knowing that NIAID...
I'm not gonna lie. After I saw, like, the nominations for NIAID, I hadn't seen it, but I was like, oh, this is one of those joke tweets going around, or, like, tossing a fake movie. I thought that for, like, a full 24 hours.
Wow. It does feel like the type of movie where, like, it would be like, why is this movie nominated? And then it's like, oh, it's produced by Harvey Weinstein. Like, that's what it used to be, right? Like,
yeah.
Why is the artist nominated for Best Picture? Why did the artist win Best Picture? Oh, because Harvey Weinstein produced it. Like, that's what it used to be. Very strange year. You know what people aren't talking about enough, in my opinion? That Killers of the Flower Moon did not get a Best Adapted Screenplay nomination.
Oh yeah, that is psychotic.
That is kind of crazy. Because it would have also been a way to give Marty a very easy second Oscar without having Killers of the Flower Moon sweep. Because he has a screenplay credit on that movie. So
yeah, what the fuck?
So I that's probably their way of just being like, we gotta make sure we give it to Nolan this time. We didn't nominate Dark Knight in 2008 and it broke everyone's brain. I feel bad if Anatomy of a Fall, like, somehow won, like, Best Director or something, people are gonna freak the fuck out.
That movie's actually, like, really good.
No, it's great, but I'm talking about, like, everyone's kind of right now being like, it's Nolan's year, right? Like, yeah, that's the attitude now that Barbie isn't gonna get everything, although Barbie might still win. But if it doesn't win, people are gonna freak the fuck out, like when that guy was all upset Joker didn't win Best Picture.
Oh yeah, that was interesting. And by interesting, I mean stupid.
I wonder how that guy's doing.
Oh, I'm sure he's completely normal now.
Do you ever wonder what it's like to be in people like that's heads, like 24/7?
No, I'm too locked in, like Enzo Ferrari.
Yeah.
I'm too locked into the drive.
Are you telling me that guy doesn't compartmentalize parts of his life?
Yeah, yeah. When I get onto this podcast, I get on it to win.
Yeah, that's why this podcast does so well.
Yes, exactly.
So he won like 7 Webbies or whatever the fuck.
The podcaster deluded themselves.
There's the podcast. If we ever make have we made podcaster movies yet?
I hope not. Well, I guess Kevin Smith kind of got that.
Oh yeah, with a Tusk. You know what? The definitive podcasting movie has already been made. Thank you, Kevin Smith.
That came out 10 years ago.
I know. He was ahead of the curve. Had he waited, it would have been a bigger hit.
Yeah. He should still do Moose Jaws, by the way. I'm completely dead fucking serious about that.
He is doing a different horror movie, right?
No, no, no. Do Moose Jaws first.
I do want to see
Moose Jaws. It's Jaws, but with a moose.
Yeah. I do want to see it, but he's doing another horror movie right now, I believe. Called, I think, the 4:30 movie or something like that. Set at the movie theater he just bought. He now owns a movie theater.
Oh, okay. Well, good for him.
Yeah, I should go there. It's like not too far. Like it's like a 4-hour drive from me. Like if they ever show something.
Oh, okay.
There, I could go. And he's like there all the time apparently. So what else is Kevin all right? Smith
well, good. Good
do?
For him. Yeah.
Did you know Tusk is kind of like responsible for A24?
Is it?
It's one of the first A24 released films, and when it was released, it was the biggest hit A24 had put out, and like it still didn't really make any money. But like,
no, it only made $1.9 million against a $3 million budget.
I believe at the time there was something where it was like it kind of worked out for A24, like
that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Oh my god, that was one of their last ones. Or one of their first ones.
Yeah, it's really early. Like, they had done stuff before that, right? But, like, Tusk was kind of this weird one where, like, I believe it did well for them. Because I remember being a news story, and it was the first time I remember people talking about A24. But, yeah. So, you know what? Now that I look at it, like, I know A24's bit is, like, kind of become a meme. Goddamn, A24, like, early on did have a hell of a run. Like, I saw a lot of these movies and really liked them back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, and they were movies that just weren't getting made other places, you know?
Yeah. No, they still put out good stuff. It's like, they're just producing more now, and sometimes you don't hit as much as you'd like, but they're a production company. Like, whatever.
I would argue that their hit and miss rate has never really changed. But... Now, I think Everything Everywhere All at Once has now, like, broken them. So, in, like, look at them, you know.
I think online, maybe. But, like, in the real world, like, I think people still respond to them.
Like my boy Vox Acoma, he loves A24.
What did Vox Acoma think of Ferrari?
You know what? I don't know if he's seen it. He's also been, like, radio silent for, like, the past 2 months because of, like, everything, so...
Oh, God, that's right.
I hope he's using the time to catch up with movies, and also, hopefully, he didn't do anything fucked up.
But... Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Nothing... It seems to have... Everyone's just moved on. It's so strange. Like, the whole company is just, like, we're back to it.
Oh, like, boy. No, I'm sure like, that'll work out.
Yeah. People are like just now it's just one of the things where like I think all the people that were like harassing the people that work there have realized it's not working, so now they're just harassing all the fans and fan artists. So
oh my god.
Yeah, it's a very calm and chill world over there in VTuber land. it was one of those things where, like, I didn't know where I stood on, like, whose side I was on, but now I'm more on the, like, actual streamer side just based on how psychotic the people against them have been behaving in terms of, like, doxing people who are just fans, which is kind of crazy to me. But, very healthy, normal world over there. Although I think a story just came out today about, like, basically, you know, whatever that company's name is, I talked about how they contract all their work out, right, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they don't necessarily make good deals with the people who produce the music, and maybe those people aren't getting royalties that they would otherwise deserve in another line of work. But, yeah, don't get involved with these companies, I guess, is the lesson. Work for Enzo Ferrari, who never did anything wrong to any of his employees.
No, he was great. He was great. I do like the one, like, hard cut after, like, he pulls the new racer off the track because he couldn't get ahead of the other driver. And then he swaps in Jack O'Connell's character, who I really like as an actor. He just pops up once in a while now, but I think he's great. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll finish for you, whatever. And then the hard cut to everyone at the table where he's going to just, like, scold them. Jack O'Connell now has, like, a neck brace on him.
I know, yeah. And that's his whole speech about basically, like, you have to want to die to do this.
Yeah.
He actually has a really good quote in there. We know it's our deadly passion, our what is it? Our something joy.
Our deadly passion, our terrible joy.
Our terrible joy. Which I'm not saying that's, like, the philosophy of the film. I'm just saying that Enzo understands the mentality of his drivers and knows how to tap into it, right? Like,
yeah.
That's really what the movie seems about, is that Enzo is very good at, like, the dealing with the different people in his life in terms of giving them what they want and getting them to work for him, you know? It's I'm not saying that's the movie's philosophy on, like, art or commerce or doing things. I just think that it's a look into Enzo being able to look at someone being like, here's what they want, I can give it to them in order for it to benefit me. Because the underlying plot of this is his, like, pretend offer to Ford, right? Where it's like, there's a great scene with the, I mean, there's that amazing scene with the reporters where he's just like, you compared me to Saturn devouring his sons, get out. Like, he just, like, throws out the reporters. And then he brings the one guy back there and he's like, look, I want you to report the story. Like, I want you to run the story where I'm entertaining a deal from Ford, and I categorically deny it. Like, and then the guy's like, if I do this, I want access to your private life. And he's like, you can, but only you can't publish it until I say so. And it's like, okay. And, like, he makes the deal. Like, it's all part of it, right? It's a weird, like, cult of personality type thing that he has going. I mean, there's literally the scenes in the church where they're like, if Jesus was around today, he'd be a metal worker. Like,
yeah, I know. I wasn't going to bring that up too.
it's a very fascinating, just, like, the type of people that can kind of get people to follow them on these sort of weird journeys. I mean, it's honestly similar to someone like Jim Henson, you know, where you hear stories about that guy and, like, how he was able to convince people to work with fucking Muppets their whole life. Like, it's, he shouldn't have been able to do that, but he kind of had that ability. And this is a guy who just, like, built, like, just was like, I can convince people to make a car slightly faster to just break themselves doing this. And it's very enjoyable to watch.
I mean, there's also that whole aspect where he didn't build Modena, but he basically built himself to be the face of that community.
Yes.
To the point where, like, for the church thing, too, it's like, we thank, like the priest is saying, like, we thank you for, like, your faith and we thank you for your medal. And it's like, whoa, like, everything in this community revolves around him. So everyone knows what his deal is, except they also don't. Like, there's levels to it where, like, obviously, with Lara, the Penelope Cruz character doesn't know about the secret family, right? Where he's, like, he's building up the life that he felt he lost when he lost his son and how he fell out of love with Lara. But also, his face in the public is one of, like, being, like, impervious. Like, he's, like, the guy who you cannot you can't cross, but you also can't like really defeat. Like he will win at the end of the day, but also he's like losing constantly because he can't keep up with his wins even.
Yeah.
Like 100%. Even the people challenging him, he can't keep up with himself at like beating them, which is like this really like that's like levels to Michael Mann's like dichotomy psychology bullshit. Like that's just
and again, not to say it's like reflective of the artist or the filmmaking process, but like I was thinking of, there's a good Sam Raimi quote I saw where I think he was talking about fucking Oz the Great and Powerful of all things, but like you were kind of asking like what attracted him to the material, and part of him, he said, like, he gave this quote where he's like, I don't really feel like he's like, after all these years, I don't really feel like I'm a director. I feel like I'm an actor playing a director, right? And you think about that with Sam Raimi, with like his whole like he puts on suits to like go to work, which is like a Hitchcock thing, right? That like he commands a sort of like the director is in charge type thing. There's so much in that that psychologically trickles down to the rest of his work in his film, right? And there is sort of that with Endo, where he's playing this type of guy who is like, you know, he's one step ahead of everyone. He keeps everyone closed off, but he's also like, you know, he's constantly on the verge of bankruptcy. Like he doesn't have it nearly as together as other people think he does. And he's really just someone who's very good at making it up as he goes along. Right. And is just willing to play it a lot closer to the chest than other people would. Right. Like, you know, there's a great scene where he's like, if you cash this check before the sale is through, like, it will destroy Ferrari, right? Like, where he makes that deal with her. And it's like he's willing to get that close to the edge to pursue whatever it is he's pursuing.
There's the, well, his son asked him to get the autograph from the new driver constantly throughout the film, right? And I just find that so fascinating that it's like at the end of the day, all these different things Ferrari tries to control, Enzo tries to control, there are some things you just that life is too chaotic and wild to ever really have a grasp on all these different avenues. So whether it's his son trying to, like, you know, be his son, or his driver's trying to be perfect for him, there's just sometimes there's just literally stuff in the road that's going to get in the way of that. And the outcomes are wildly unpredictable, and occasionally even dangerous. And that dude gets fucking just destroyed, and it's one of the most viscerally upsetting images I've ever seen on the big screen.
I saw that when I saw it in the theater. It was just me and my father. We were the only two people in the theater, and we were both just kind of like, Jesus Christ.
But I want to go back to the Women of Ferrari really quickly, because there's Lena Lardy, Shailene Woodley, Laura Ferrari, Penelope Cruz, and then his mother, who is like old and bitter and is just kind of along for the ride and very funny at times too. She gets like a couple big laughs in the movie. I don't know this actress's name, she's terrific.
Honestly, she is very good.
I think it's Daniela Piperno. Let me check really quick. I want to get this right because she fucking cried. Yeah, Daniela Piperno, who I'm not familiar with. If I've seen her anything before, I don't remember. She's also an actual Italian, so you get one in the movie. but these three women in the film, I think they're such fascinating.
Are you telling
me
Penelope Cruz is an Italian?
I could have fooled me, right? They all have such different like avenues of life, where like Daniela Piperno is just like, his mom is just so like, she's so stuck in the rigid old ways. Like, the woman has to like just follow the man and like do what the man says. Like, it's just easier that way, even though she's also like deeply unhappy. Like, one of her first lines in the movie is like, you know, I'll tell you, the wrong son died, because her other son died in the First World War.
No, possibly.
And that's how she like opens the movie.
Yeah. Possibly the most Italian thing in this movie is what you're saying of her being like, She is stuck to the old ways of like the traditional role of a woman, but she's gonna let you know for the rest of her life she's unhappy with it. Like, she's still gonna do it, but you're gonna have to hear about how unhappy she is forever.
And so she's constantly in conflict with Lara, who is like kind of the one who's greasing the wheels for Ferrari Enzo to keep going, and also the company. Like, literally, she's in charge of like the finances and the books and stuff like that. And she's the one who bears the emotional brunt of it.
Yeah. And she does the work that Enzo won't do. Like, she's always like, when that one driver dies early on, like, she handles, like, closing up the finances on that one, right? Like, mm-hmm. which it's like, Enzo wants to keep, like, a sort of emotional distance from all that. And she's, like, kind of left to clean it up. And it's one of the kind of fucked up things she's doing. And it's a weird thing of, like, yes, she's still in service to him. But I think there's also that thing that happens, I think, between, like, younger and older generations, where the older generation resents the younger one for having more opportunities, essentially. Like, she has this chance to kind of rise out of it, Penelope Cruz's character. And then there's also the sniping about, like, he wanted more children, but you couldn't give it to him, which is fucked up. Like, it's really good. It's great stuff in terms of just film. But, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to this movie about cars.
Yeah, I just want to wrap up on her and Shailene Woodley's characters too, because they never meet in the film. Mm-hmm. I do not know if they met in real life. I assume at some point that must have happened, but it's not essential to this narrative. Where Lara's introduction is just like devastating in the aftermath of, like, I described the beautiful opening with, like, the valley and the quiet house and the quiet drive away from, like, this perfect family home, and then you cut to, like, their home, and it's just, like, dark, and like Penelope Cruz looks so tired, and she's, like, shooting a gun at the wall, which is, like, a very, like, I think that's kind of almost like a trope even for, like, tough women characters. I think a lot of people, like, look at Goodfellas and, like, they see the scene with, like, her on the bed over Henry.
You name another Italian film as an example. You name another Italian.
Yes.
So, although she's Jewish in that scene, so. But.
Well, they couldn't reconcile them, their differences.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Fucking. But yeah, like. Yes. We're ultimately pro Italian for the most part. Got to do something about that governor, though. Anyways. But no, I just. It's such an effective way of communicating, like, the differences between these worlds visually. And that's a shout out to Eric Messerschmidt, the cinematographer. We talked about how, like, this is a more, like, traditional Michael Mann movie, like, in terms of, like, its direction. Mm-hmm. And, like, the talking scenes, the dialogue heavy scenes, they're always shot much more, like, classically, you know, like, over the shoulder stuff or, like, shot reverse shot, never, like, boring or, like, uninteresting. But, like, I guess just after, you know, we mentioned, like, the run from, like, Miami Vice to Black Cat, which are just, like, the coverage in those dialogue scenes is, like, fucking insane sometimes. I'm like, who even thinks to shoot that, and why is it working for me? This one is, like, a normal movie when people are talking, but when they hit the cars and the racetracks, that's when it's like, all right, let's shoot in, like, a 21mm hanging off the side of the car. Let's get right close to the wheel. Let's fucking, like, you're in it. And that's when it's, like, his digital experimentation starts getting, like, crazy again.
While we're on Eric, it's genius. Messerschmidt, he's returning to this retrospective from Mank. He was the cinematographer. He won the Academy Award for Mank.
Yeah.
He's recently worked on David Fincher's The Killer, and he worked on Mindhunter. So I guess what this movie really shows is that it depends on the director you work with in terms of showcasing your qualities as a cinematographer.
Boo! That is not a defense of Mank. I think this guy is very talented, though. And
no, he definitely
clearly
is
a cinematographer down to try shit, which I really like.
Yeah, I wish he worked with a director who was willing to try more shit. But hey, do you think Mindhunter looks good as a show?
I think it looks fine. I think it looks good. Like, yeah, good. I don't want to say fine. It sounds half-assed, but, like, it's good. It's a good-looking show.
Fine is the word I would use as well.
No. I don't know. I don't know what else to bring up about Ferrari. I mean, I could obviously keep going all day, I
sound is
be
incredible. Sound is incredible in it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait. Just because I keep forgetting, you keep talking about, like, the idealistic opening of this movie, like, with him, like, kind of quietly leaving that lifetime. But there is, like, a dark element to that, which is, like, literally him, like, that is an example of him compartmentalizing everything. That he's, like, he's keeping the world so separate, right? That, like, he doesn't even want to disturb the silence of it, you know? There's definitely, like, a romantic angle to it of, like, he doesn't want to wake her, but I mean, we get... there's a reason they show Shailene Woodley like after that, waking up alone in bed, right? Like that's why that shot is like mixed in with everything. He wasn't just doing it out of the kindness of his heart.
He doesn't want to disturb it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's even is like when there's the big scene when Penelope Cruz shows up and finds the toy car, it is a big like the two worlds colliding type moment, that these worlds that weren't supposed to overlap are now overlapping. So to bring back the sound design, this is incredible. It was amazing on the big screen, seeing it in a good theater anyway. And I will say the one, I don't know if anyone's made this connection, but did you think about when they're doing the racing scenes and, there's the one shot where they're on the driver and like, he'll kind of drive past the crowds really quickly and then in between the buildings and then past the crowds and like the cheering will cut in and out of the sound. You know, the scene I'm talking about,
The final race.
Yeah. During that.
Okay.
When the sound, it's like the cheers will cut in and out. Like it'll be like cheers and then silence, just like the sound of the car. It reminded me of The Shining. Famous scene with the kid on the bike where he'll ride the bike over the hardwood and then the carpet and then the hardwood and then the carpet. And I thought it was like really effective in how it was used here. So,
you know what? It's so effective. I didn't even really notice that.
Oh really? It really,
yeah.
It really left an impact on me. It kind of was like the weird like punctuation of just like, you know, just like the intensity of this sort of driving. You get that when you're on the road, right? Like.
Oh yeah.
Even just when I'm driving to like fucking a Walmart, but like.
When I'm driving to work in the morning, there's a stretch of the 605 freeway that is so smooth, and I get on to the 91 if people who want to hijack my car because it's a piece of shit. That's my road to work in the morning. There's a stretch on the 91 where so many trucks go over it, they're just never going to fix the potholes. And I feel it in the car all the time when I make that shift, when it's like, okay, this is the part they're never going to fix. It's like it grinds a lot more, where the 605 tends to be smoother, at least for that section of it that I'm on. But yeah, I noticed that difference. It's terrible. Someone please steal my car. It's fucking, it sucks.
You want to cash in that insurance?
Yeah, I just want a new car. I know. No, actually don't now, because now I'm going to, I might cut that joke. That might
All right.
Be.
All right.
Yeah, that might be too much. Now Ferrari is fucking great. I saw it first in Dolby. I got that early access showing because I got that A-list. It was really great. The sound was terrific there. I saw it in a normal theater after. My first movie of the year, by the way. And the sound was a little less good. So I don't know if it's an audio thing, like a mix thing, or if it was a theater thing.
I'm going to go out like and say it was a theater thing.
Yeah, but I will say at the end of the movie, when he's talking to his son, he says, I wish you could have met Dino. When they walk on the gravel, it does get a little louder randomly. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't catch it on the rewatch at home, so maybe it was the theater thing. But anyways, this is a great movie.
Yeah.
I will talk about another Michael Mann movie at some point. Hopefully not Heat 2 on this podcast, only because I don't want it to fail.
You don't want to, well, you know, you never know. I don't know what I feel like Michael Mann is one of those ones where like he's huge in film Twitter and it just isn't connecting with the world beyond it. Right. Like,
yeah,
he hasn't developed that sort of following outside of film Twitter. Even though he had one outside of it for the longest time, which is odd, but, It's not, we're not like rallying every time there's a new one, you know?
Yeah, it's just me.
Yeah, which, you know, whatever. Like, we're not here to do the business of this industry, but.
No. I just want him to keep having opportunities. I don't give a shit about the money.
He too could be the one, though, that like gets him back. So that would be kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But he's 81.
The interesting thing is that.
How much he's going to do more, but, mm-hmm. You know, keep on trucking.
The interesting thing is Heat didn't make like a god load of money either. No. Like it made its money back, but it wasn't like the original Heat wasn't like a box office smash.
Yeah, but if you
everyone just recognized it as like the new best movie ever made.
That article about how much of a disaster filming Miami Vice was is a window into where the industry was at the time, because I think it was the head of Universal, because they were like, because that movie, it kind of bombed at the box office, right? Like it didn't really make money. But the head of Universal was like, it's always worth taking a risk on Michael Mann because he does so well on home video and cable. It was like every Michael Mann movie has turned a profit at this point because they do so well on home video and cable. And that was where the industry was in 2006. I don't think that really exists anymore. And I think the fact that it has kind of gone away maybe explains the slowdown in output that Michael Mann has had, where there was a huge gap between Black Hat and Ferrari. I think that was more like that used to be the thing, is that he was a much more in very similar to John Carpenter, where he just did better on home video for whatever reason than in theaters. And unfortunately, we'll probably be one of those guys that just never gets an Oscar in his career, right? Like,
yeah,
it's that's just not going to happen. But you look at Michael Mann, like, I don't think any of his movies were ever like huge box office draws, right? Like,
no,
Collateral's probably the biggest one. $65 million made, $220 million. Like, yeah. But that's about it. Yeah, Last of the Mohicans is probably the other big one. But yeah, wasn't really a box, never like a box office guy. So I mean, there's entirely a chance that we could probably cheat and be like, Heat 2 made money, but it didn't make $500 million. So technically, it's a failed blockbuster.
I'll fucking take it.
Yeah, why not? I mean, we could straight up just do Heat in that it didn't. It's not an Oscar winning movie, right? Like,
oh yeah, yeah.
We could just do that.
Jesus Christ, tackling Heat, that's like fucking that's a feat.
I need to undergo
like a Michael Mann level like analysis and like research on that movie. It'll take me like 3 years to research before we talk about it or something.
The only problem with Heat is that like everyone's covered it, right? That like what could we bring to the table on Heat? But
Black Hat,
on the other hand, I think we could bring something too.
Yeah. There might be something there.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention at the top of the episode, the movie that Ferrari beat in the poll that we ran for this retrospective was Patch Adams,
which I would have loved to have done. A Tom Shadyac joint.
Well, Robin Williams. We never get the chance to talk about Robin Williams.
Yeah, I mean, we could arguably like find reasons to talk about Robin Williams, considering his career. With like floating with Oscar nominations multiple times. But Tom Shadyac is probably someone who we will talk about him and never speak of him again, unless we want to do Evan Almighty one of these days.
No, that's okay.
Because Evan Almighty famously was like the most expensive comedy ever made when it came out and it bombed. If almost as if God was mocking the hubris of Evan Almighty, that movie had $175 million box office, budget. And it made $174.4 million at the box office, within $1 million of its budget.
That's so fucking funny.
And it didn't happen. Have you seen Patch Adams? Just like throwing that out there.
I don't think I have. I know the image of Robin Williams in the outfit.
Yeah, with the nose, right? The red nose.
Yeah. And there's a bit in Community where Abed was hiring like impersonators. Like he was addicted to hiring impersonators, and then he hires one to do Patch Adams bits for some reason.
Well, you want to hear? Do you have any idea what to expect from Patch Adams?
Because we will. Well, he's like he's entertaining kids like that are gonna die, right?
But he's based on a real guy.
Oh my God. No, I did not know that.
Patch Adams is a real dude. I believe he's still alive. And it was kind of an advocate for like, you got to treat a person. You got to treat the patients like mental, like, you know, at the same time as their physical stuff. Like if they feel better as a person, they will it'll help their health too. Right. Like not just that, but like he believed that. And there's a lot of stuff we can talk about the real Patch Adams. But just to give you a hint at the movie, Roger Ebert gave Patch Adams 1.5 stars and wrote, Patch Adams made me want to spray the screen with Lysol. This movie is shameless. It's not merely a tearjerker. It extracts tears individually by liposuction without anesthetic. So I look forward to discussing Patch Adams one of these days.
Wow.
The real life Patch Adams also apparently hated the movie.
Oh, okay. Well,
so
huh.
There's that too. We'll unfortunately, embarrassingly, we will probably talk when we do Patch Adams. It'll probably be longer than this episode just because I have so much to say about that fucking movie.
All right. I mean, hey, sometimes a good movie speaks for itself, and that's why these episodes tend to be shorter.
I only feel bad just because, like, it's more just that Ferrari is so fresh. I haven't really had a chance to watch it over and over again, you know? I feel like if I had more time to watch it, I would find more to it. So,
Well, I can quickly run down some responses because I asked people on Twitter for the first time for this retrospective, like, what everyone think of Ferrari and
but all your why did they snub Penelope Cruz? Like all your fucking friends are going to like Ferrari, though.
Well, here, at your tugboat cap'n said, you got to understand that America Ferrari gives that speech like 30 times. That's why Penelope Cruz wasn't nominated, which I'm not pitting queens against queens here. Sorry. Call me Matt 88 said I liked Ferrari, maybe not as much as some diehard manheads, but I walked out of theater confident that Cruz and the sound team would be nominated. It's one of the best performances of the year. Like, what are we doing here? Let's see, at Rainy Night Intinen, terrific movie that feels like man telling his own life story through Ferrari, how it mixes up his usual workaholic angle by having our title character want to share that love with the people around him, but being unable to is what makes it for me. At Prince M2319, not his best work, but I really enjoyed it a lot, emotionally warmer than expected and funnier too. I dug the paradoxical relationships that Enzo has with people, especially Lara.
So Italians are funny to this man.
Yes.
He finds Italians funny, huh?
Italians are hilarious.
I mean, he's not wrong.
Yeah, you guys have the gabagool. That's just an inherently funny word.
Yeah. Guma. What was I going to say? So far, no one has given an explanation as to why they think Penelope Cruz wasn't nominated.
Yeah, no.
It's just pain. I have an explanation.
Racism.
Yes.
I don't know.
I was going to say that. Racism. But I don't know. It is one of those where, like, I just feel like this movie, it came out, like, it hits theaters like this, like wide release December 25th, right at the end of the year. Didn't have time to build momentum, and then the momentum didn't even really happen. So, it was just... And it is kind of one of those... I feel like if Adam Driver hadn't done House of Gucci before this, it would have been more of a legit discussion, right?
I think so, too. Yeah.
I think that really, like, in a way, kind of hurt it. No offense to House of Gucci.
No, and I like House of Gucci. I've said this many a times, and I'll say it again. The difference between that movie and The Last Duel, because Ridley Scott did them both in the same like time frame. Mm-hmm. The Last Duel, he shot, and House of Gucci is covered. Like in the footage, you see like he's thinking of very specific sequences in The Last Duel, and in House of Gucci, he's like, let's just let the people go crazy in the performances, which he does, and. I think it ends up kind of suffering because of that, though. Not for the performances per se, just like the way he covers the actual dialogue and stuff like that. But yeah, the Ferrari kind of wipes the floor with Gucci. It kind of runs away with this lunch.
But Gucci also like made like 3 times at the box office.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Maybe that's why Ferrari finally got to happen, because of Gucci and Ford v Ferrari. Yeah.
I do think that's part of it. I really do think it was like it's Adam Driver of it all, like. It is one of the things where I'm really glad Adam Driver is throwing his weight around to get interesting movies produced, right? Like, that he's in that spot where he can kind of do that more so than I think a lot of the other people that came out of Star Wars. Although I heard there's a Daisy Ridley movie coming out that's, like, supposed to be, like, she's supposed to be really good in it. So I'm looking forward to that, whatever it
ends up being. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, she doesn't have, like, the producing weight that he has
Yeah.
But I kind of hope she can get there because, like, no one dislikes her, you know?
No.
Like, I mean, we all recognize she's good.
The other difference is that, like, she was, like, basically an unknown when she did Force Awakens, right? Like, she'd done a little bit here and there, but was basically an unknown. And, I mean, she could totally fall into the, you know, Mark Hamill realm, which, you know, worked out well for Mark Hamill, but... It did get in the way of a more blossoming career, but she doesn't have the weight to like kind of be a producer. But hopefully, I would love to see it turn around because I love Daisy Ridley; like she's great and stuff. So,
yeah, I say this with complete love and sincerity. I would love for her to be able to get like that producer weight or like have her name basically get something greenlit because I would love to see her do something like 65, a movie I didn't think worked.
Yeah,
but I kind of love that it exists and that Adam Driver takes it super seriously. As seriously as any other performance.
Oh my god, Daisy Ridley fighting dinosaurs would be amazing.
Yes.
Like, I mean, it's I felt similarly about Kristen Stewart when she did Underwater, whatever that movie was called. Where it's like Kristen Stewart should be fighting more monsters in movies. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm glad she's got this like sexy bodybuilder movie now. But like, you know, do that and fight monsters in the same movie.
You don't have to do one or the other. Like, she can do both, right? Like, but I...
She's multifaceted.
Yeah, I want to see her fight monsters. Like, I want to see her... I just want to see her fight weird Cthulhu-looking monster-type things. But, yeah, the new movie's supposed to be really good, apparently. Love Lives Bleeding.
Yeah.
I've heard good things, so...
Yeah, shout out to Beyond Fest, which was like, we're selling tickets, and then immediately had their website shut down because they never figured out how to fucking channel all this data into their website, so no one gets tickets to these things anymore. Sorry, I'm just venting about shit again. I think
that's something Beyond Fest should have figured out by this point. I did not know.
You would think so.
Yeah, you would. You
would think so.
Although, doesn't like the Comic-Con website crash every year? Like, maybe they just never bother to figure it out.
Yeah, I just kind of going by the skin of my teeth on that one. But that was Ferrari.
Yes,
there's only one more episode left to record for the retrospective.
One official. You never know what might happen.
One official. Yes, I think I do know what's going to happen, but we'll save that for later. What we are not going to save for later, and just going to tell you right now, is that our final official recording is of the 2017 film The Snowman.
Oh boy. What did The Snowman do?
Thelma Schoonmaker right was brought in to save that movie.
A lot of people tried to save that movie. goddamn, we'll have a lot to talk about that. That beat Dr. Doolittle, right? The old one.
Yes.
Which that makes sense, honestly. But
honestly, I could throw that back into the failed blockbusters for next season. I won't because we talked about what we're going to do, but
we basically already planned the failed blockbuster season. We're not going to do a bracket this time. We've already picked the movies. So,
oh, are we not? There's a lot of them.
We're doing all of them.
Okay, that's a lot, but okay.
I'm ready to without spoiling things. We got like a few more of these to do. We got another kind of a special retrospective coming up we're going to do. And then we're going to jump right into Phil Blockbusters. And then we're going to do that shit through the fucking election. Because I need something to keep my mind off the state of the world.
You know what? That's fair.
And once you find out the theme of the Phil Blockbusters, which is a theme this year, it makes sense for this year specifically. Yeah,
yep. No, I didn't see it until right now, but I definitely see it now.
That's why you're the host of this podcast, Diego.
Yep, it's going great. It's all good. Everything's great. Goodbye, Jonathan Demme. Links down to our stuff in the description below. Matt, thanks for joining me again, as always.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's your fucking privilege to have me here. God damn it. I don't know what I'm doing.
It's our deadly passion, our terrible joy. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for watching.
Oh, God, it kind of is. Oh, God. Oh, no. I'm gonna fucking drive this podcast off the road, Diego. God damn it.
I know.
You take that turn a little too quick.
We had to give another episode. I gave him one. I gave him one. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for watching. Like and subscribe. If you didn't like this episode, like and subscribe because you might find something to do. Like, take care. We have been professionally unprofessional. Goodbye, Judy Foster and Nyad.
Oh God. Goodbye.